Hey guys, Brian Beeler here, and welcome to the podcast. This week I've got Steve Searles on with Zimcom. Zimcom's a cloud service provider these days, but back when I started with Steve, it was almost two decades ago, co-loading servers for hosting websites. So Steve and I have known each other for a while, and he takes us on their journey to be an all-flash data center today, which is really cool. He talks a lot about their needs for storage. They're a nimble Pure Shop today, but that could change. A lot of conversation about how they're using OpenStack and some of the projects like Cinder to really benefit what they're doing, and a little bit on why HCI won't work for them, why they use Blades, and a lot of other fun technology challenges that service providers are running into. So great conversation. Let's bring in Steve and get going. Joining me on the podcast today, we've got Steve Searles. Steve's a longtime friend and operates Zimcom. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Brian.
So tell I know what you do. Tell the world what you do over at Zimcom and what your role is there.
All right. So Zimcom is a public cloud provider and a data center company. And actually, we're owned by a larger company called Liberty Center One. We went through an acquisition about 3 years ago. And I am the CTO of Liberty Center One.
Excellent. And so you and I have known each other for, gosh, about 20 years at this point through a variety of websites and things. I know we had the early websites with you back in the day when we got tired of hosting it in our own building. I think, well, you're literally across the street from us. I think we drove the servers over there and placed them in your colo way back when, but things have come a long way since then. You've grown up a lot and we've grown up a lot. I know we just went through a migration for the storage review site to your more modern architecture. What did we do in terms of our movement with you?
Well, what you guys did is, going from the beginning, you went from a colo situation to a VMware-backed cloud that we had deployed, and we ran for about 7 years. About 5 years to 6 years ago, we decided to shift our operations to a, use this term a little loosely, a little more cloudy type operation instead of using, where we added a lot more optimization, a lot more automation in our offerings. So we deployed OpenStack, which is a cloud management platform, fairly well-known cloud management platform, and shifted our hypervisors off to KVM. So now we're using all-flash storage, automated storage deployment, and KVM is the back-end hypervisor.
So did you guys ditch VMware entirely?
No, we still have a VMware cloud. I don't think we can necessarily get rid of VMware completely, but KVM is more designed to integrate directly with OpenStack, and it had been kind of a logical choice for that platform going forward.
So the dream for service providers like you and many others with OpenStack was to be able to get to something that was more cost optimized to help your metrics, to help you be more competitive, all that sort of thing. But, you know, that was the talk 5 or 6 years ago. And then a bunch of people went and tried it and found out it was really hard and cumbersome. And I'm not sure what the breakdown is anymore, but we're hearing it commonly used with MSPs, but also with telcos. But what's been your experience with the OpenStack journey?
Well, I would say OpenStack's not for the faint of heart. if you're looking to deploy OpenStack, you're deploying it for a reason, a specific use case. Again, a telecom, a service provider, you really need the source code to integrate with your existing systems. Some things that other closed proprietary systems will not allow you to do. So you make that decision very much on purpose, and you know what you're getting into. But to be successful with OpenStack, you have to have a very solid development team. OpenStack's primarily written in Python, so you need some Python developers and some Python knowledge. And you really have to have a team that's centered on keeping it running. So it's not for an enterprise deployment as much as it is a service provider product, at least in my opinion. I would think that the enterprise would probably lean more toward some of VMware's offerings, like VMware's cloud products and things
sure.
like that.
Well, okay. So did you know what you were getting into? You obviously did the research before you pulled the cord, because that's not an inconsequential investment of time and resources. But did you really know what you were getting into, or were you surprised once you guys started committing and tearing in?
No, we really knew what we were getting into, because our previous cloud platform was a product called CloudStack, which has kind of an interesting background. They started in Texas as a company called cloud.com in the mid-2000s, moved and were sold to Citrix. And Citrix released it as a product called Cloud Platform, and they really didn't have a whole lot of luck with it. After a few years, they released the project to the Apache Software Foundation, where it sits today. Mm-hmm. It's still a viable cloud platform product, and we use that with a VMware backend. So that was our legacy cloud. OpenStack had a little bit more momentum in the marketplace and had a lot more developer support and a much more open framework. CloudStack is primarily Java, whereas OpenStack is primarily Python. So it allows us to get into a younger set of developers that are more forthcoming and produce better results. It's also much more modular, whereas CloudStack tended to be very monolithic.
Huh. So Python development skills. So, you know, you and I are in Cincinnati, where we operate, but you've got data centers in what, Dallas and Detroit as well?
That's correct. Yep.
So where did you find these Python guys? I'm just curious how hard or easy it is to find that skill set in those markets, or do you not care where they are?
We really don't care where they are. I find Python developers are pretty easy to get a hold of. Most of them are going to be, we can find locally here in Cincinnati. We can source via some of the recruitment websites that are out there, but it's a very common language for people to have.
Huh. So you did that on the software side. What about the hardware side? I know back in the day you were a big EMC shop, or at least had some relative investment there in what, VNX or something, right?
Correct. Yeah. And that's one thing that's really great about being a data center and having been through a few mergers and acquisitions, we've played with just about, and we have on our floor pretty much every logo that's out there.
Is that a benefit? Like, in terms of mashing together data centers for a service provider, ranging from a pile of golden retriever puppies to Freddy Krueger, where does it fall on the nightmare scale?
Actually, and that's where OpenStack really shines, is we can use, there's a project in OpenStack called Cinder, which mm-hmm. controls block provisioning. We can have multiple backends. So whether it's provisioned on a Pure array or a Nimble array or an EMC array, it doesn't really matter. And through all of these acquisitions, we've had a push to move to an all-flash data center about 3 years ago, which we accomplished, I think, somewhere around the September-October timeframe of last year. We got rid of our last spinning disk array for our production storage. So that's been really cool.
So if you've got all this mishmash of arrays for your storage, are you seeing, because the vendors will talk a lot about their OpenStack integrations and, you know, as part of their bulleted list of feature sets, and it's hard because we rarely have time to look into those types of specifics. Is that legit, or are some of those guys full of crap?
I would say that you're all over the board on that one. Your major players, your EMC, Pure, Nimble, Hawaii, Cam and Aereo, those guys, they're all legit. Some of the other ones are lacking features, or you might be able to create a LUN but not a snapshot, or you might be able to create a snapshot but not mount it, that sort of thing. But all the major vendors are pretty legitimate on their support.
So if you're going to manage all these different storage platforms, though, that's got to be a pain in the ass if you're not sure what the feature set is across them, isn't it? Or how do you mitigate that?
Well, I mean, and that's why we don't build our own storage, Brian. I mean, a lot of OpenStack deployments out there are either much larger than us or much smaller than us. We're kind of in that middle territory. For us, due to risk and compliance, it's a better move for us to purchase storage from a known vendor. Whereas, you know, a lot of guys, especially if they're doing this in a lab, they're going to set it up on, they're going to deploy Ceph on some super micro boxes, and that'll be their right. storage backend. And some of the really big clouds, like your Amazons and your Googles of the world, they'll build their own storage, but they got teams of guys to deal with that. So in the middle market where we're kind of playing, it's better and more efficient for us to just buy from a known vendor. Now, as our storage ages out and support, as our support contracts expire, we are trying to get rid of the and settle on a single, maybe one or two well-known flash vendors, which will kind of get rid of that problem. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about building your own, because we do hear from, and it's funny because if you think about service providers in the, it's just such a wide spectrum in terms of what that means. It could be a guy out in the sticks who's, you know, helping a couple small businesses set up WordPress sites and manage them to, you know, what you guys are doing, then all the way up into to much larger operations. But one of the things that we hear so much of from a lot of SSD guys and even some of the tier two chassis guys like a Supermicro or AIC or whatever, is that they're doing a lot of facilitation when it comes to MSPs and helping them put together cheap storage, or even if it's all flash, and they're still selling a lot of SATA disk into that space, which kind of scares the hell out of me from a reliability standpoint. Not that there's anything wrong with SATA SSDs, but there's a lot of limitations to what you can do, and especially at scale, and you know, it wouldn't be a performance tier. But I don't know, how long did you think about building your own stuff, or did you ever experiment with that?
No, we really never considered it. And here's why. I mean, if you're supporting one company, building your own storage array is fine. If something happens to that storage array, you have one company that goes down. In our environment, where we have, where we're a large multi-tenant environment dependent on many storage arrays, if we lose one, that could potentially affect, you know, 50, 100 companies, 200 companies, who knows? So by purchasing from a known vendor with 24/7 immediate support, that's what we're doing to leverage our risk, because as a cloud provider, we have to have a niche, or else everybody would use one of the big three. Our niche is in data protection and security. So in data protection, we're leveraging a lot of the snapshot functionality, a lot of the functionality that you find intrinsically built into these all-flash arrays. And that also prompted our movement to all-flash, is, you know, where we'll run, you know, 10,000 snapshots on an array in any given day. If you try and do that with some of our legacy arrays, they of course would not survive that. Not taking a performance penalty because of that has all led us to buying known all flash from a known all flash vendor. And it's a risk. If we build something and something goes sideways, which, you know, never happens in IT, right? and it's not going to happen during the day. It'll always happen at 3 o'clock in the morning when everybody's asleep. They could fix it. So that's how we're kind of mitigating risk.
Yeah, that's interesting. So let's walk through the storage review example. So you've got our site. Where do we currently sit? Is there one data center that we're in?
Yeah, you're primarily in the Cincinnati data center.
Okay, so something happens there, whether it's storage failure or something else that goes offline. What's your plan for us so that I don't call you at 3 a.m. and say I got the alert from whatever that we're down?
Well, what would likely happen, again, there's a lot of redundancies built into those arrays, but there are snapshots are offloaded onto another device where we would just bring that, restore that LAN, essentially, in your case.
So what about, I don't even know what we're set up for these days, but if you were to lose Cincinnati for whatever reason, I know where you are down, you're still downtown, aren't you, at that data center?
Yep, we're downtown on West 7th Street, and we, the same in Dallas, and we also, our wholly owned data center is in Detroit, so it's where our corporate headquarters are.
So what's the time if you were to lose one of those for some reason to be able to spin up in another geo? Is that something that you guys worry about?
You know, each customer is different, and it depends on how you deploy inside of our public cloud. Just like any other public cloud, we have multiple regions and we have multiple availability zones. So if a server is deployed on a protected volume that's in another availability zone. It's a matter of booting it there and handling any ramifications from IP fallout. If it's a portable IP that's going across, and it really kind of depends on the nature of the failure too, Brian. So if the data center is actually dead offline, there's bigger problems. if it's a storage volume that's dead, that's pretty easy to deal with. It's from a, and IP is not involved, but yeah, everybody fails differently, I guess. Yeah. is how I would say, because some of our clients use technologies which you've reviewed on your website for making real-time copies of things, and certain software to have multiple cloud availability zones up all the time. So everybody's a little bit different.
Yeah, it just depends on what you want to pay for too. You know,
correct.
To have that that soft and fuzzy feeling at night. So talk a little bit more about your move to all flash. It's something that, you know, the Array guys have been wanting everybody to do for the last 5 years. What is it that finally got you to that point last year? Economics or performance or other capabilities? Just sort of curious on your thoughts there.
I got to admit, it's a leap of faith, because you're looking and coming from somebody who is a big iron vendor with, you know, EMC. We had several VNXs deployed, fully populated with a bunch of data on them. And, you know, you're looking at, okay, if this is what I'm paying for storage now, what am I paying for storage going forward? And then I sign a new contract, get some new arrays, and off you go. But then the upstart, this all flash stuff, came on the scene. And we were really interested in it from performance, because we have IO Blender like no other, because we have sure. such mixed workload. And, you know, our first attracted us to all flash was we pretty much eliminate that IO Blender, at least to a point, with the speed of all flash. But then there was the economic issue where we're like, oh my gosh, this stuff's so expensive. Does it really dedupe like they say it will? Because, you know, there's often a disconnect between the actual engineering versus the sales talk. Are these guys telling me the truth? Do they want $1 million of my money? Or are they not going to deliver? So we kind of stood by a little bit to see how the industry shook out, and the flash prices started to come down. And it is a leap of faith, especially if you're not a Fortune 500 company. You say, okay, I'm going to buy a storage array that costs 3 to 4 times what I would normally pay for this amount of storage. I hope this dedupe works. Cross my fingers. Hope I have a job in the morning. But there were other things that were behind it too. Again, it's that snapshot functionality. Is, you know, you've got a rise of things like CryptoLocker. You've got a rise of, you know, all kinds of malware which can be mitigated very easily with a storage snap. Obviously, that's not a backup, but it's something that you can roll back to. Now, you know, companies have been doing this for a long time. One of the companies that was part of our M&A had compellent arrays, and they were running huge snapshot change on these compellent arrays, which were really common. Performance was dreadful, though, once you got to that point. So we took the leap of faith, and we said, okay, we'll try the all-flash stuff, and we haven't looked back. Regardless of vendor, we're seeing similar dedupe and compression data reduction factors across them. Each company's salespeople will say that they're better, but from a mixed,
well, I mean, you know the numbers, right? Just look
right
at it.
From a mixed workload standpoint, and we have quite a variety of workload, they're the same. They're kind of shaken out about the same, the two major flash vendors that we use anyway.
All right. Well, who are you using? You want to tell us or no?
Sure. Pure and Nimble.
Okay. Yeah, I remember when you were looking at the Nimble arrays. Gosh, I guess it's been, what, 2 or 3 years, or is it longer than that?
We started initially by looking at an Extreme IO from EMC, right. And we had good luck with that array. It was a decent array. We couldn't come together on price. Then we bought a Nimble array, and then we bought a Pure array. And all of those purchasing decisions were driven by economics at that time.
Okay. So how's Nimble been as HP? Were you before the HPE acquisition?
It was right at the HPE acquisition when we purchised Nimble.
So and how's that going now?
It's been fine. Really, both vendors have been really good. You know, there was a lot of misinformation going out around the time of that acquisition. Oh gosh, don't buy Nimble. Your stuff's going to explode because they bought by HP. No, nothing really happened. That was all really just a paper tiger.
Well, the info site that Nimble had, which was one of the primary reasons that HPE went in on that deal, people loved it then. It's grown across their platform. That they've got it across their server line and other products, and now they're really bubbling that up as their overall, or one day, their overall HPE portfolio management and data visualization software. Is that something that, as a service provider, you guys use or care much about?
We use it, but again, the ability to see all of your arrays and their performance is really good for our teams who manage our infrastructure. But no, not really. I mean, most of our interaction with our storage arrays is handled via API. So,
right.
So yeah, very rarely are we logging into the arrays anyway. But I think that that's kind of a trend in the software industry. I think a lot of your storage vendors are really becoming software companies.
Yeah, it seems that way. I mean, they've got to broaden their offering because there's so many. I don't know if you looked at any of their or paid much attention to the software defined space these days, but right when I thought it was going to sort of peter out a year or two ago, like then now there's another big surge of guys out there that are trying to offer better economics on all flash arrays that are software defined. Or there's a couple guys like Formulas Black and Vast Data that are trying to use the new technologies, persistent memory from Intel or some of the Optane SSDs to change the metrics, pairing that kind of stuff with real cheap QLC NAND. So did you look at software defined at all, or do you care?
I did. I actually had a discussion with Formulas Black, a few meetings with them, and their stuff actually sounds really interesting. I'm not going to say that I understand completely what they're trying to do. The problem is it doesn't really fit inside of our infrastructure yet,
right?
Because you have to define that manually, like an enterprise admin would. And since we have a requirement for nearly everything to be automated, it doesn't fit yet. But that doesn't mean that Formulas Black wouldn't be something that we would use for HPC offerings going forward.
Yeah, I guess you'd really need a client that wanted a special setup for whatever reason, and I guess you could carve out a slice of that in your infrastructure to address that need.
They seem to be kind of playing in the Violin space that was vacated by Violin. Would you agree with that?
Well, I mean, they really want to be able to tell a performance story. And the interesting thing about persistent memory is, you know, Intel dropped that, and at the time of the release, there wasn't a whole lot to do with it. And so now it's really taken a lot of these software guys to come along and take Intel's API calls and stack, and then go modify it so that it's a little more ready for enterprise apps. So yeah, I think it's one of those technologies that's cool, and has a ton of potential, but really needs the software layer to tie it all together.
Yeah, and I think as it evolves, the next year should be really telling as to where that space moves. But we know that the demand for I/O and storage isn't going anywhere but up, right?
Mm. So what do you do now if you've got a high performance need? Is the pure Nimble combo able to do that if you need somebody that wants, I don't know, some ridiculous throughput for whatever reason?
Yeah, they are currently. But you know, I expect that we'll probably need a different solution should an uptick come in that realm.
So in your OpenStack environment, do you view storage as tiers then? How do you think about that? Because this is sort of your primary mainstream tier, but you must have something slower, cheaper for backups or archive or whatever else you're doing there.
Actually, not typically. We used to,
really?
And then we flattened it all out. Yeah, we find that our consumer of our cloud is really expecting for things to work and work fast all the time, reliably. Again, since we leverage a lot of storage snapshots, we really kind of said, okay, we're going to standardize our storage pricing, and we're just going to give everybody all flash. That way, we don't have to categorize data or be dependent on the customer to categorize their data.
Hmm.
And that's worked for us over the last couple years. However, now there's a resurgence in saying, okay, we need a cheaper tier of storage. And we're currently in a vendor selection looking for a cheaper tier of storage. But our requirements are going to be, you know, we'd really like it to have a fiber channel backend. We'd like it to have OpenStack support. And we'd like to buy it at a price point that we can offer it to our customers and, of course, still make money with it. So,
damn capitalism.
Right, exactly. So, but we can't use a very cheap storage array again because of the risk factors that I talked about earlier. We need a legitimate low cost storage array, and if we can get it in an all flash form factor, that would be preferred too. Because again, maintenance on an all flash array is nothing compared to a spinning disk array.
How much does in your data centers? How much is the power suck of hard drive to flash or the cooling, or have you, I'm sure you've looked at those economics.
It's huge. We used, I think it was, and I want to say 48 amps to power a Compellent array that took up two cabinets. And for the same capacity, we're doing in four rack units with, I think, a 4-amp draw. So, I mean, it is night and day. The heat generation is nil. And PUE, if you were doing PUE, you typically do that across an entire data center. But if you're doing it across a rack, it would be light years apart.
Yeah, that's funny because I remember, you know, back in the old colo days, it was, you know, every rack you cost whatever, right? Because you had finite space. And obviously the space is still somewhat finite now, but the ability, especially with you, to be able to take all these multiple workloads and just slam them down into a tiny little thing is pretty awesome. So thinking back to that, the tier two thing, if you could do it in all flash, it's weird because that what you're looking at is just a gigantic scope, anywhere ranging from, I guess you could do it with a decent NAS all the way up to sort of lower end products from the big guys. Like, what are you even considering there?
Well, you know, we've looked at a couple things. We've looked at true NAS boxes. Pure announced a C-Series flash array, which looks very promising. We, you know, requirements for us is we need a feature set that's similar to what we currently have. One of the, you know, and this is kind of a gray area in storage, at least to me. You know, a lot of the guys listening probably have a different opinion. I'd love to hear it. But it's kind of a gray area where if you're trying to store a lot of data cheaply, most people would turn to object storage for that.
Right.
The customers that are requesting it from us are looking for block back volumes because this is typically monolithic workload. This is file servers. This is, you know, typically Windows boxes or NFS shares, things that are storing, you know, normal file system data, and they have no way to consume the object storage in that manner. So it's kind of a unique use case because the object storage doesn't play well, which is the perfect use case for it. And all flash doesn't play well because it's too expensive. So,
what's a guy to do?
Right. That's where we're at. I mean, speaking quite frankly, that's where we're at. And there's a lot of things we can do. It's, can we get to a price point that our customers are happy with?
And how much gap do you need between what you offer now and what this other tier would be? And the follow-up before you even answer is, do you worry at all that, I mean, we're maybe one of your smallest possible clients, but do you worry that they could say, well, we don't need the high end. We can drop, you know, a couple bucks off the bill by going down to this lower tier. Does that concern you at all?
It does. That's probably my biggest concern. And that's why we said, you know what, regardless of whether it's file system data or your boot volume, you just put it on all flash and be done with it. Yeah. My biggest concern is that people will take a cheaper option with less redundancy and less security if we offer it. And that's why we're being very, very careful as to how we would place this. Like, you know, we had some roundtable discussions that says, okay, maybe we will not permit it to be used as a boot volume. All right, fine. But that doesn't solve all of the problems. The problem to me is we market ourselves as a data security and a data protection company, and I can't offer an inferior level of storage because that's really all that matters to us is the storage and the data integrity. So again, if we can do it in all flash with a reputable vendor like we're using today, that's where we would kind of lean toward. I don't like to go backwards into spinning disks, so that's the least preferable route for us.
Well, that undoes your all flash goal of 2019. You can't go all flash and then undo it.
Right, exactly. And there'd be no reason we would, but you know, the salespeople would say, well, then we would just change it to all flash for tier one data storage. But you know, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the C-Series array from Pure is very promising. Nimble has a all-flash that is a little cheaper. I've looked at, you know, we've looked at some others like Caminario, and we're really just waiting for all of the quotes to come in, and that's one of the difficult things. We've been purchasing storage for many years that they're all over the board as far as pricing. So,
there's still no uniformity. If you want to go buy 100 terabytes of flash, you're still seeing a massive chasm between the quotes.
Yes, yes. And that's typically the case, especially with a vendor that you haven't worked with before, because not having established relationships also make that chasm even worse. So it's frustrating, but we'll get there. And I just want to make sure if we do offer a lower tier of storage, which we currently do not, if we offer a lower tier of storage, that it has 95% of the 100% of the data integrity, but maybe 95% of the speed, if we can get there.
So on that pricing variability, I think a lot of people would assume, and just thinking through the problem, I would, that access to components for the vendors might be part of the problem, especially with SSDs. So, you know, we know for a fact, talking to a couple of them, that they've got the SSD vendors, that they've got engagements. I wouldn't say they're preferred engagements, but they certainly have their customers like a Dell EMC that get all the supply first that they need. Then, you know, the tier two guys get what they need. And I wonder how much of an issue it is for the smaller vendors to be able to deal with that variability. And I know they'll respond, well, we can use any drive, doesn't matter. But at the end of the day, you'd like to have some semblance of uniformity in the SKUs you offer, because I can't sell you an array that's got a mishmash of Samsung and Intel SSDs or whatever. It doesn't work well that way.
Right, and that's what we're trying to do, is keep uniform across our offerings too. My biggest concern too is I think that this might actually be a moot point. I think that as the pricing of this SSD and all flash storage continues to go down, I think there's kind of those two products are kind of munged together. And I think, you know, maybe in a year's time, year and a half time, we're going to say that storage is just storage, where we were 2 years ago when we started introducing all flash and saying that's all we're going to do. So it's really, we get a cost reduction and we pass that on to the customer, and this becomes a non-issue. That's where I think we're going to wind up.
Well, it's felt like that for a little while, at least on the array side. And we can talk servers too. I know you've probably got some thoughts on that. But on the array side, like you found in your dedupe numbers, you get to the same end spot of 3 or 3.5 or whatever the number is. I don't think you said, but
we're getting north of 4 on both.
Really? Okay. So, yeah, so north of 4. Uh-huh. Okay. So you're getting that across everything you're using, and you're using a wide variety of things. So then, if that's true and the performance is similar and the snapshot and other functionality is similar, like you get to the point where it's more of a cost-based decision, as long as the reliability and support's there. But I don't know if you paid much attention. Dell last week, or maybe the week before, launched the PowerStore, and it may not be super applicable to what you're doing, but for the first time in a while, they did some interesting things, like they've got this ESXi integration that you might not care a lot about that drives their apps on things. They're letting, in certain use cases, put apps on the storage, which is kind of cool. And they bumped up their data guarantee, their compression and dedupe, I think to 4-to-1 guaranteed, which is, you know, right with what you're seeing. So that's no big deal. But did you pay attention to that release? And is there anything there that's interesting to you?
I did. Actually, our Dell rep got a hold of one of our engineers, and they passed me a sales slick. So I'm sort of familiar with this new product. So I looked over it, and yeah, that data guarantee is pretty solid. That's one of the things when you first purchase your all-flash array, you're like, okay, again, you're putting out a lot of money on a promise from a guy that you don't really know all that well. And if they're willing to guarantee it, which, you know, a lot of those, the of all flash vendors started doing about a year, 2 years ago. I think that that's great. As far as the apps on the array, I don't really understand, and that's probably, I'll admit, that I just don't understand where that would be applicable for a service provider. I think in an enterprise, that might make a lot of sense, where you could have like a Docker container, Kubernetes serving file, or other services on that array. I just don't know that you'd run actual workload. Don't you think there's kind of like a crossover there of do I have a hyperconverged or ACI infrastructure and then I have a storage array, right?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And it's even more interesting, I think, because they've got both scale up and scale out. So they took that from concept from
ScaleIO or Scale.io.
Well, yeah, and pulled that forward. There's a lot there, and we're actually just starting to have the conversation about how to dive deep on some of that stuff to see how it works. But yeah, it does feel in some way a little bit like HCI, but they really don't want, you know, all your apps on there. It's clearly not designed for that. But getting some of those data analytics things closer to the data makes some sense. So there could be something there. I think it's just going to depend on the apps and what their customers start to do with it. As with anything, I think, you know, the customer is going to drive the conversation here, and we'll see where that goes. Speaking of HCI, did you ever consider those solutions? You know, probably not vSAN, or maybe in the early days you did look at vSAN and and some of the other things. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, we've looked at HCI on several occasions, because HCI is very popular with cloud providers, and it would work in our environment. The biggest problem is that we are not only a cloud provider, but also a data center. So we also sell storage as a service. In most HCI solutions, you're not able to provide a fiber channel LUN or an iSCSI LUN to a consumer. So that's why we stuck with the typical compute storage stack. That doesn't mean in the future we wouldn't move to an HCI solution. It's just we're not there yet.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. It's what you made a point there about the differentiation between cloud providers and what you're doing. Just clarify that point a little bit.
Sure. So what I said was, not only are we a cloud provider, where somebody would come to us and say, we'd like infrastructure as a service or self-service infrastructure as a service. We have all of that multi-tenant infrastructure for them. But in some cases, co-location is still alive and well, where somebody might have five or six cabinets of gear and they wish to either decommission their data center and find a place to consolidate their data. So our data center in Detroit is about 20,000 square feet. We've got about 300 cabinets worth of space up there for co-location.
Okay. Yeah, I think if you look at your world, how many guys are doing that still versus just being a front man for other cloud services and really more taking a consultative approach at that point, I suppose?
Well, I've seen a lot of consolidation in the industry, and what I'm seeing is where colo provider, we'll start with colo, where typically colo providers would you know, be smaller shops, MSPs, you know, they'd source some hardware because they're familiar with it, put it in a colo, and that's how they would service their customers. We're starting to see that decline and in favor of using cloud products like our offerings. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing colos very much alive and well in the enterprise, where somebody might want 5, 10, 20 cabinets. Those people are typically not making large-scale jumps to the cloud, at least the ones that we're working with. Conversely to that, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Well, they're still going to they're taking the intermediary step of getting it out of their office, right?
Yeah, either out of their offices or out of an older data center that no longer meets their compliance requirements.
Oh, and
it's generally compliance, which is driving this. You know, they need a SOC 2 compliant facility and they don't want to go through the audit locally. So they'll hire a data center like ours that has had a SOC 2 audit, and they'll move their data or their physical assets into there. They still can come and go as they please. They can maintain it. They have their compliance and security, and everybody's good. The smaller one is the MSP market. This is the one that I find a little more interesting. The ones where, you know, they would have a cabinet, they'd have some of their servers that they're maintaining. Either they're getting sick of buying hardware, they don't want to be in the hardware business anymore, they're moving to a purely remote support company. They start to look to cloud providers to say, what can we do to to get out of this infrastructure and use your cloud services to do that.
Okay.
So one of the verticals that we work is the MSP market, whereas an MSP would resell or rebrand our cloud as their own. But what we offer for that MSP is enhanced data protection abilities, you know, the snapshotting, the all flash backends on really nice arrays. Those are the things that we bring to them that they couldn't typically or wouldn't typically want to afford. And they get to brand it themselves. So that's a vertical we work quite often. And we're starting to see some consolidation into the private cloud market there, whereas the MSPs no longer want to be a cloud. They're just going to buy one. And on the enterprise colo, we're seeing enterprise influx to certified data centers now.
Huh, that's interesting. So I mentioned servers before. I want to go back to that. What are you guys doing there?
Typically, we're using blade servers. And I was actually going to comment on this
blade
earlier.
Blade servers, oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm. And there's a couple reasons why. We're using Intel's Xeon scalable blade servers. But what I was going to say earlier was our storage arrays are no longer generating the heat. It's the blades that are generating the heat or the compute. The reason that we use blade servers is very simple. We want to cut down on cables. It's a lot easier.
It's that easy, huh?
It's that simple. Since we're using a storage and compute architecture that is disjoined, so it's not the hyperconverged. Hyperconverged is where you would use the typical 1U, 2U servers to do that. In our environment, we want to cut down on cables because we're hyper redundant all the way through. So if we were to deploy, let's say, a typical Dell server, we would need two fiber channel cards, not just a two-port card, but two cards. We would need two four-port 10-gig Ethernet cards or maybe a 40-gig Ethernet card if we put them in there. All of those things generate a lot of cable mess for us. So it's easier for us to take, 40 and 100-gig fabric interconnects and use that to distribute through IO aggregators to the blades. So, blades are alive and well in this market. I know there's been a kind of a movement away from them, but for us, it saves us, 70% on cabling.
Yeah. Well, we still see them. We had a super micro high density blade guy in that was, 5 or 6U, but had, I forget even how many had 16 or 18, modular servers inside. And, Cisco's, of course, made a living off of those UCS minis.
Ones.
And yeah. They're around. And, Dell Forever, the M1000 chassis?
M1000.
They sold a ton of those.
Yeah, we still have several M1000s deployed out there. And the M640 is the latest blade that goes in them. They're coming with Xeon Platinum processors in them, 28 cores apiece. I mean, they're pretty stout blades.
Did you ever look at that MX7000 platform that Dell launched?
We have, and we're actually in vendor selection for our next line of compute.
You're in vendor selection for everything, damn.
We're in constant vendor selection, Brian. We cycle our hardware out about every 4 years.
Sure.
So we're constantly, every month we pull servers out and put new ones in. So it's kind of a revolving door.
So what are you looking for in a blade, in a modern blade platform?
Well, and that's a check and balance too, is when you're running a cloud, more servers is generally better for us because we're not that concerned with things like socket-based licensing. We'd probably rather have more servers to distribute workload than just a fewer number of really large servers. It's kind of like a storage array. We obviously have to maintain our servers. So when we evacuate them, just like you would in VMware doing a vMotion, it takes time to move that workload off. Am I moving a terabyte and a half of RAM or am I moving 768? Well, that's half the time. So how quickly can something heal is just like a rebuild time on a storage array, So we're looking for, a platform that's going to scale up and out, and it's probably going to be determined on what interfaces are supported. Does it support 100 gig Ethernet? What kind of IO aggregators are available? Does it have the ability to go to 32 gig fiber channel? Stuff like that. So those are the things that we're going to be looking for as we select the next platform. And then we'll be doing it all over again in 4 more years.
Well, you know, I was thinking, because since you're not a big VMware shop, you know, there was a couple of weeks ago, AMD kind of got the rug pulled out from under them a little bit on VMware changing the licensing scheme from sockets to cores.
And AMD, I heard about that.
Yeah, AMD, of course, has a bunch of heavy core count CPUs. And so now a two-socket box, if you want their 64-core CPUs, is now a four-socket box, but you still only have two physical CPUs.
Didn't, so but didn't nasty. AMD release a, didn't AMD release a socket or a processor to specifically deal with that and then turbo those cores?
They have they've got a number. They've got a couple at the 32-core count that I think were clearly architected for that need. But they've also got a bunch of high gigahertz, low core. They've got high core. I mean, they've got all sorts of things going on. I was curious to see if any of the compute guys on the Blades have shown you anything from AMD. I'm guessing it's still maybe too early for the Blades to accommodate that. But have you spent any time with AMD?
Admittedly, I have not. I've looked at some of the stuff when the Threadripper first came out. I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. Because, again, if you're running a lot of VM workload, you're concerned about thread speed and thread count that you can get onto a box. And they look super promising. I don't think Dell offers any of the Epic stuff in the Blades yet. I could be totally wrong about that. I think Supermicro does. At this point, is the only one I think that has it, and like I said, I could be wrong. Actually, well, you'd know better than I would on this stuff.
we don't. It's funny because we get a lot of outreach on like 2U4 node kind of servers for HCI or SDS, but we don't get pitched a lot on the high density because I think that generally speaking. While you may consume a lot of Blades and guys like you, that the enterprise is some of them still have Blades, but most have moved off onto standard 1U, 2U boxes. So we don't hear a lot from those guys on Blades. And then to be fair to like Dell and HPE, 90 whatever 2 or 3, maybe even more percent of their business is Intel. So to architect a server, a 1U or 2U for AMD is one thing. To architect their micro infrastructures onto yet another platform, that's an entirely different undertaking and may not be worth the effort.
Yeah, and I think a lot of this stuff you're going to see, you know, the storage vendors, I mean, they probably have taken a hit with cloud providers like ourselves. I mean, I can think of several examples where a customer was set to buy, you know, a lower level storage array from one of these vendors. And they said, you know what, we're just not doing it. We're going to go to a cloud provider. So their customers are really going to be us. We're going to be the ones buying the bigger storage arrays and the higher density Blade chassis to facilitate that need. That's where I think the market's going.
Yeah. Well, speaking of where it's going, you hit on networking a little bit. You're on what, mostly Ethernet for server traffic. What else are you doing? Your fiber, you said, obviously.
Fiber channel, yeah. Yeah, I've always been a big fan of fiber channel, not because I'm, you know, 40 years old, which is like ancient in IT these days.
I feel the same way.
Well, I found that having my engineers, you know, fiber channel is great because it forces you to keep your storage network and your data network separate. Just by nature of being a different protocol and a different switch altogether. iSCSI was introduced, you know, and there's nothing wrong with iSCSI. It's just really to combat the human nature of wanting to mix that stuff together. Again, we're trying to run the most reliable and highly available cloud offering for our customers. And that's why we use enterprise gear to run the cloud. Most clouds are built on commodity gear. And that's where, I guess, where we differ is our mission statement is not really how cheaply can we sell a server. It's can we sell cloud, but have it be as reliable as you doing it yourself?
Have you, again, this ties back to VMware a little bit, but we're looking at doing some work with Mellanox on their ConnectX cards and their NVMe over Fabric setup now that VMware supports that, but have you looked at anything? Maybe you don't even need it, but any of the Fabrics stuff with your environment?
No, actually, I have not. There's another gentleman in my organization, one of my storage guys, who's heavily pushing for that sort of thing. But no, I myself have not looked into it. Mellanox is impressive, though. I saw many years ago, you showed me a 1U Mellanox switch, and I think it was a 40 gig 1U switch. And this might even be 5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
And I've never even seen anything like that. Mellanox has some really cool stuff.
Yeah, they do. We love working with them. And it's funny because they were so far out ahead of the curve with their initial InfiniBand work. Gosh, it's probably been 6 or 7 years now, back when, you know, SMB3 to Microsoft servers was a big deal, and you could pump all this this bandwidth, which was pretty sick. And at the time, I don't even know if all the enterprises were even on 10G at that point. I mean, it was just so far out ahead. And now we see all the time environments that we get in that are based on 10 gigs still, but have all flash inside, and the network is a clear hindrance on the performance. So, you know, I can't hardly imagine wanting to deploy an HCI anymore of any, you know, reasonable scale that's not on 25 or better.
Right. And this technology is changing so rapidly. Whatever you buy today is slow in 10 minutes, it seems.
Yeah. Well, certainly could be. So, you know, while we're bunkered down a little bit here, are you, as you're looking at these things and how to make the services you offer at ZimCom better, are you playing at home? How are you sampling these things without spending as much time in the office?
Well, you know, fortunately enough, and, you know, I hope you and everybody else are certainly stay healthy and well. We are in a fortunate industry in IT to have not been affected too greatly by the work at home orders. Since a lot of us are telecommuters anyway, it was really just another day, except for we can't go to the grocery store as often and all of those things. So you're stuck in your house. But I mean, as a company and as a business, we've actually seen a large uptick in our cloud usage. So we've been doing maintenance windows during this lockdown, adding compute capacity, because we're seeing a lot of people are, this is the impetus to finally move out of that office data center that they had and move into the cloud. So we've been busier than ever, mostly doing migrations and working with our MSP folks in doing those type of migrations. But no, it hasn't slowed down at all for us, Brian.
Well, that's good. What, you know, I know you do offer a lot of other services. I was playing around on the website earlier today, and I know you and I have talked about Veeam before, but you're offering their Cloud Connect product too. I'm just sort of curious how that's going for you.
Yeah, we're a Veeam Cloud Connect partner. Veeam's a good product. You know, we protect a lot of VMware and Hyper-V environments with that. We also use Veeam as a migration tool to get you into our public cloud. The nice thing about our public cloud is it will read any file format. So we can boot VMDKs, we can boot VHDs, we can boot just about any image format out there natively without even a conversion process. So that works out really well for providing disaster recovery for customers that are on those Cloud Connect platforms.
Yeah, we've actually started to do, as we've grown our team, been able to do a little more technical work there, and we've published a number of pieces on the Veeam product, and their management console for service providers is something they're really proud of. We haven't, you know, spent a lot of time there, of course, but, you know, they do take care of, or at least they try to take care of, I think, guys like you that are out there reselling their solutions and give you tools to manage it. I don't know if you've spent much time on that.
Yeah, absolutely. We have, like I said, I've got guys who head up our Veeam division, but I've seen it and I've played with it a little bit, and it is it's pretty cool. When they've made, especially with the latest release of Veeam 10, that console has improved vastly over the last year. They're constantly making changes to it. So yeah, it's a very useful tool. The biggest thing for us is the ability to have multi-tenancy. Just like our public cloud, everything's multi-tenant, right? So we need the ability for a customer to log in, check their own backup jobs, schedule their own recovery, self-service recovery into the cloud. All of that stuff is very important to us. So Veeam's doing a good job providing that so far.
Yeah, well, that's cool. Yeah, we use them here in our lab, and it's been great. Yeah, Rick, I don't know if you've met Rick Vanover. He's up in Columbus. He'll be quick to tell you that he and I went to preschool together over off of Mount Carmel Tabasco Road, which is a little troubling. The first time he came down here to hang out with Kevin and I, he said, yeah, well, you and I went to preschool together. Like, who's this psycho? Which was pretty funny. Do you remember anyone you went to preschool with?
No, I can't say that I do, man.
And then he starts asking me, he's like, oh, how's that other guy or that other guy? I'm like, you out of your mind? How would I remember them? But now when I see him, I call him Little Ricky, because that's what how my mom remembered him. And so that's pretty fun. Trying to make that catch on within his company at Veeam so that he is forever Little Ricky at that organization.
Oh, you bet.
Yeah, well, you know.
He's going to love you for that, Brian, for sure.
He definitely does. Well, you know, back when we went to events, oh my gosh, it's been brutal being stuck on the ground. I mean, I'm not used to just being here this much. And all these guys are trying to run virtual vendor events, and I just can't get into it. It's such an awful way to convey information. Have you guys been doing any of these virtual vendor things?
You know, not typically. I'm like you. I mean, I love going to some of the bigger events, and that's, I'm going to certainly miss that. I read an article from CNBC this morning that was talking about the change in the workplace environment, but the only takeaway that I got from it was they're saying, you know, conferences and those things may be a thing of the past.
Well, yeah, I think it was Microsoft said no events until 2022 or somebody like kicked the can way down the road.
I think those events are awesome because I get to go and talk to other cloud providers, even competitors, and we get to hang out, and it's collaboration between even businesses, and that you know, those are things that all of us, I think, look forward to every year. Your EMC World, your, you know, Ignite, you know, even South by Southwest interactive.
No, you're absolutely right, and that's what I try to tell some of these PR guys when they're like, well, why won't you come to our thing? Because sitting in front of the computer watching you tell me something that I already know you're going to tell me for 3 or 4 or 10 hours is like, there's no value add there. The value add is like you and I running into each other, then grabbing a beer and talking about whatever's going on. Like that's the meat of those things, not necessarily the keynote. And I know it would make Dell Technologies weep when I say that to them, but like watching a 2-hour keynote, it's fine, but it doesn't move the needle at all. It's all the other interactions that you miss. So yeah, well, I get what you're saying about events maybe not coming back, but I don't know. I think there's just something so personal about that touch that they're not going to be able to avoid that.
Well, I don't think I think that we will revolt until there's an event, but you know, I mean, at least not until there's a vaccine. Again, most of the fun business and all of that happens outside of the keynote at those little tables that are hardly big enough to hold a drink. But yeah, that's where we all have our fun. So I'm going to miss that this year. But I think that we're on the right path. But those who say that events are canceled for 5 years, I think they're probably not right.
Well, they probably have heavy investments in Zoom stock or whatever. Yeah, well, I'm aware of one that's planning an in-person in October. So we'll see how that goes. It's funny because, like you said, your business is doing well. We're doing well too. And I was thinking, well, geez, how can we maximize that? And how can we even get someone to meet with us? Because out of Cincinnati, Delta's cut back their nonstops to only the hubs, so Minneapolis, Atlanta, Detroit, and maybe Salt Lake. And so I don't need to go to any of those places. I need to go to the next place. And so flying, even if you're willing to take the risk, is a bigger pain in the ass now than ever, because now I've got to go to Detroit to get to Boston, or Atlanta to get to Austin, or whatever. And it's a drag, and double planes, double exposure, all that stuff. So I thought, man, what if we took an RV, put a storage of you wrap on it, like a half rack in the back, and drive it across the country and meet with these guys and do demos of products in the storage of you van. Admittedly, sounds a little creepy now that I'm saying it out loud, but there's got to be a way.
No, I mean, that actually sounds kind of fun. I'd love to drive coast to coast. I've always wanted to drive out west. I've never had the opportunity to do it.
Why would you want to drive? That's like a 5-day drive.
Because you want to see what's on the – I wouldn't say I want to do it more than once. Just want to do it once.
Well, maybe we can get the van, go down the East Coast. So I got to hit Hopkinton down to Raleigh and then swing along the south and end up in the Bay Area, and then we can fly back.
All right. I'm in.
That'll probably take us about a month.
I think we can make it happen.
All right.
We know we're capable of working remotely, right? So you're in a van. I've seen some executives take these Sprinter vans and turn them into like rolling offices, and they've actually done a really nice job with them. Those are cool.
Yeah. That's what I'm thinking. And now I just got to convince the vendors we work with to be brave enough to, maybe I'll just park it in their driveway. What we need is a rooftop bar on this, if we're really thinking through this the right way. Park it in their driveway, have that ladder dude, you climb up on the back of a couple chairs and a little kegerator up there, and we'd be good to go.
Insurance agents who are listening to this are cringing right now.
I wasn't going to get any insurance, but that's a good idea. I'm glad you've brought sanity to this operation. All right. Well, speaking of feeling old, I've got to go and end this fabulous conversation. We're using this time to actually hire a little bit, and we're going to bring in a social media manager, which, you know, if you think being in your 40s normally is bad, talking to these kids out of college that are going to put together a social media program for us is devastatingly depressing. It's a whole different world these days.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun, Brian. I'll let you get to it.
All right, Steve. Thanks for joining us today.
All right, Brian. Thank you very much.
Hey, so I want to thank Steve again. You can check out Zimcom at zimcom.net, Z-I-M-C-O-M. We've used them forever. Storage of You runs on Zimcom, so if we're ever down, blame them. Although that said, Kevin is recovered from their snapshots more than once without having to go to the backup. We tend to do a lot of edits on live sites because we can. If you want to reach out, hit us info@storagereview.com. Find us on Reddit. We've got a fun little Instagram, Facebook. We got it all going on. So find us, engage with us. We'd love to hear from you and get your feedback. Thanks for tuning in. Bye-bye.